The Triathlon Show 360. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Paulo Sousa. Paulo is the coach behind one of the longest standing and most successful international private squads on the short course triathlon circuit, and is working with some amazing athletes, primarily in short course racing. We list all of them in the episodes. I won't list any of them here. He's also the coach of middle distance athletes Erik Lagerström and Paula Findlay. And in this episode, we discuss his squad, how they operate, where they train and why, the short course triathlon scene, things like the racing season and how to work in training between all those races, and just in general get to hear a good amount of Paulo's thoughts on training and coaching. But before that, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create sports nutrition products, including both fueling and hydration products, and they help you use them effectively through a range of free tools, services, and content. The Fuel and Hydration Planner on their website is a one-stop shop for figuring out an effective race hydration and fueling strategy for you. It's free and super easy to use. It only takes a couple of minutes to answer a handful of questions, and then you get a detailed, simple, and effective race plan. They also offer free video consultation, and as a listener of the podcast, you can get 15% off your order of their range of electrolyte and carbohydrate products by using the code TTS22 at checkout on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Indoor Swim Trainer is a unique dryland swim trainer that allows you to improve technique, power, and swim training consistency. It is a perfect tool to complement your pool and open water swimming, as it allows you to do very specific power and technique work, including working on your catch and your core activation, and it makes it easier to stay consistent even when you can't go to the pool. You can even use it to do activation work before pool workouts or open water swims, or you can do swim, bike, brick workouts more easily. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days, so if you don't love it, just send it back. And you can get a special TTS bundle, including the swim bench and a bunch of Senate training plans and on-demand workouts on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Paulo Sousa. Hi, Paulo. Welcome to the Triathlon Show. How are you doing?
Hi, Michael. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. It's been a long time since we've talked, but it's great to have you back. For the many new listeners we have, can you please introduce yourself and tell us a bit more about yourself?
My name is Paulo Sousa. I'm 51 years old. I'm a high performance triathlon coach, focusing mostly on the Olympic triathlon.
Yeah, and in that environment, you have over the years built up a really great squad. Can you tell us a bit more about how that came about, first of all? When did you start that, and how has it evolved over the years, and who are the current members of the squad? Mm-hmm.
Well, I started the squad back in 2010. The squad since then has had many forms, many models, many athletes. I feel... It's been a different environment and a different entity every year with different people, different ways of working, different models, different locations for camps. In the last few years, going into Tokyo and currently, we've had a stronger focus on Olympic triathlon. And now I have quite a few athletes that are focusing on Olympic triathlon. Let me pull up the list of athletes here, because the last time somebody asked me about this, I forgot one and I couldn't I was in big trouble. But the list of athletes by alphabetical order is Cecilia Santamaria, Claire Michel, Jean Leher, Kaide Kivioja, Maxime Hubert, Moose Brugger, Miriam Casillas, Natalie Van Coverden, Roxana Slupek, Sarah Vilich, Seth Ryder, Summer Rappaport, Takumi Hojo, Taylor Spivey, and Yuko Takahashi. And these are the guys that are focused in World Triathlon. And in addition to that, I also coach Eric Lagerstrom, who's been with me for a long time, and also Paula Findlay. And these guys are focusing on 70.3 and PTO races.
Yeah, I got it. Well, for anybody who follows the World Triathlon racing, there's plenty of names there that they will obviously recognize. Sure. Some really great talents there. And I think you had, was it 6 athletes that qualified for the Tokyo Olympics?
We actually had 7 athletes in Tokyo, yes.
7 athletes. Uh-huh. Yeah. So it's very successful in that with that kind of standard. So how much time when you're with the squad, how much time is spent on camps, and where are the locations that you base yourselves when you're on camp? Mm-hmm.
Well, the time spent at camps also, it's one of the things that that has changed through the years. It's going to be dependent on where we can get a maximum number of athletes together in the same place, and also where it makes sense for athletes to be at camp. So it varies, but usually we have a camp at the start of the season that we're going to be in the same location more or less between January and end of April, and then we have a camp that is going to be around the summer, and usually it's at altitude, and then we have a camp in preparation for the end of the season that's going to be September, October this year, November as well, and this will depend a lot on the race schedule. I think you know that when it comes to world triathlon racing, the race schedule ends up being very different. Also, a big driver for the end of the season is going to be the grand final, and the location of the grand final usually decides when it is in the year. So if it's in a cold place, like for example Edmonton, Canada, the grand final is going to be early in the year, maybe end of August or September. This year, because it's in Abu Dhabi, it's going to be in the last week of November. So all these factors come in and decide when and where we're going to have camps. In the last few years, we've been based or doing a lot of our off-season work in Portugal, in the south of Portugal, and we're going to go back. There at the end of this season. A big focus as well for us that was like interrupted by COVID is to have one or two altitude training camps during the summer, and we usually use Font Romeu in France to do that camp. But also in the past, when it made more sense, we also used a lot Flagstaff, Arizona. The main deciding factor for the location of these camps is going to be a location that's going to work. And in terms of triathlon training, there's not going to be a lot of locations worldwide that are going to be really good for swim, bike, run. So it ends up that these locations are chosen by mostly by necessity of like a place where we can go and train without constraints, without environmental constraints, in a way that we can just work freely at a place. So it ends up that when we list all these places, there's not going to be a lot of places around the world that are going to fit our bill.
Yeah, no, they're the same few places are used by most everybody who mm-hmm. Who does the same kind of operation. Mm-hmm. When you have, do you have all of your camp athletes usually present, or is it a mix of some people will be at all of the camps all the time unless they're racing, and others will be mm-hmm. more sometimes home based, sometimes at camp. How mm-hmm. does that work?
Well, we have a very, very flexible way of working, where mostly because at the squad, there's always been athletes that are at different levels of development and with different necessities and also different race schedules. So it ends up that the camps are there to when it works for the athletes and when it works for their race schedule. So basically is we don't have a structure where we have camps that revolve around, for example, like the WTCS calendar or the World Cup calendar. We have camps that we can get when we can get people together and we can have work groups that are preparing a block of races or can work together for a period of time. That's when we set up the camp, and so ends up being very flexible in the way of the athletes are at camp. I am at camp. We are working together. Ends up being tailored to the athletes, and then ends up that because we have a large number, we can have work groups that are going to be at the same place at the same time working together.
Got it. And you mentioned already Erik Lagerström and Paula Findlay, who are focusing more on the middle distance and PTO races. They are based in Oregon. I'm sure many listeners will be following their YouTube videos and so on. So they're familiar with that. How do you find that that sort of more constantly remote coaching relationships works compared to having athletes come join you at camps?
Uh-huh. Well, ends up that being, you know, even pre-COVID, a normal season means that a lot of athletes are going to be at different places from where I am, and this might be for personal reasons or for race calendar reasons. So it ends up that like the squad does not only work when I'm there and everybody's there and everybody's training together at the same in the same place, and so the mixed model between online coaching and remote coaching and in presence coaching is always going to be there. Of course, with COVID and the season 2020 season and the 2021 season ended up that ended up putting everyone in that mixed model of online, remote, and in person. So ended up that like everybody is already in that let's call it wavelength, in that way of working where a lot of the work it happens remotely. So ends up being like the same way that I work with Erik and Paula. I would say that like another strength of the model of working with Paula and Erik is that I've known these guys for a long, long time. I've coached Erik since I think 2013, and I've known Paula and followed Paula since 2009 when I did a training camp with Triathlon Canada in Maui in 2009, so these are guys that I know very well as well, and so it ends up being easy to work with them at a distance. I happened to like spend a week with them a few weeks ago in Bend, Oregon, which was great to just work with them for in person and also check out their training environment. It's really nice out there in Bend, so I enjoyed the week that I spent with them.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. Definitely seems like a good place to train from the videos. And what do you think are the differences in how the different squads that exist, especially when we focus on short course racing. There have been many, and many new have come up since the time that you first started your squad. Do you think that there are big differences in training philosophies between the squads, or are differences more related to things like the culture and how the squad operates more in general terms rather than training terms?
I feel that, maybe this will sound a little self-serving, but I feel that a lot of squads, or it's not like it's a large number, but a lot of squads were I wouldn't say like inspired, but for sure some squads like mine or Joel's, because we had the podcast around I don't remember, like 2015 or 2016, where we shared a lot of like how our squads work and how we operated and all that. And I think that was like a starting point for a few coaches around the world to create their own squads and start their own squads, and or they probably like already wanted to do it but found some sort of inspiration in the podcast and what we shared in the podcast. So I end up thinking that a lot of the squads that are out there, they work very similarly to my squad or Joel's squad. I the main difference that I see is that a lot of squads are also like our federation squads, and those guys have way more resources than a private squad like mine has, and they end up being able to do things that we cannot do just simply because of lack of resources. And so the resources associated with squads that are federation squads, I would feel like would be like the main difference. Other than that, kind of like I feel that, you know, I don't want like the word formula has a negative connotation, but I would say that like a lot of coaches that started their own squads kind of like used a little bit the formula that Joel and I put forth on that podcast back in the day, and I feel that, so I see a lot of things in those squads that we all were already doing.
Mm, yeah, no, that makes sense. When you look at the federation-based squads that have bigger resources, what is it that draws athletes to private squads like yours when they might have, depending on the country of the athlete, of course, but you have, for example, American athletes in your squad that I would guess in theory have access to maybe more resources and more support in a squad supported by their federation, but yet they still choose to come and train with you. What is the reason for that, and for other athletes in the same situation that do that make that choice?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the case of the US, they run like a fully decentralized model, which means that since I worked at USAT for this 2018 season, and you could say that like during that time they had a more centralized model, in the sense that like I was a federation coach and had a federation squad, but they have since went away from that model. But to answer your question, I think that like the biggest drawback with federation is that decisions are not always made with the athletes in mind, and athletes are steered or guided through decisions that fit federation strategy and not individual strategy. And so I would think that like the biggest draw of having of being coached by me or being part of our squad is that, you know, we are 100% athlete centered in the terms that like there's no wider agenda when we make decisions. the decisions are made by the athletes, and they are in function of like their needs and their wants, and not because the federation decides that this athlete needs to go to this race because they need the points for Olympic qualification or whatever it is, or this athlete needs to go to this camp because a better athlete is going to be there and needs a training partner. So all those dynamics are not present in our squad, and I think that can be very liberating for the athletes, where they can just focus on triathlon, and like I said, that can be very liberating and empowering for the athletes.
Yeah, it's an investment for them, I assume, because they, with a federation, they would usually get all of that for free, but then the athlete can choose to invest in themselves and kind of get rid of some of the politics of it all. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, well, in a sport where federations have a lot of power, athletes never really get away from politics completely. But I can tell you that I've had both experiences of being a private coach or a federation coach, and I can tell you that when you're a federation coach and the athletes that are from that country feel the politics on a daily basis when they're on a federation squad, and that day to day, having to deal with day-to-day bullshit is not going to be something that that is present in our squad. So basically, we are able to, on the day-to-day, focus on doing our job and focusing on performance. And once in a while, obviously, through a form of an email or a phone call, then the federation politics will come in. But there's a big difference between having to be immersed in it or just having to deal with it when it happens.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So when you have new athletes that come into the squad, are there any things that you would say that they normally find, or at least with some kind of frequency find, that, okay, this is different than what I'm used to doing, that the athletes have typically done before? And I mean, obviously you have athletes coming from very different environments, but maybe something that surprises them with the way you and the squad operate.
Yeah, I think like you said, experiences are very individual and dependent on the environment that they were in before. I think the biggest strength that our environment has is that we are able to maintain the drama to a low level, and being able to just really focus on the work and improvement and performance. I feel that like other squads, other environments, that a lot of the times there's too much of a high school environment that we work very hard to curtail or to diminish, so that we are able to focus on the day-to-day work. In terms of training, I feel that the biggest thing that I see is that there's a lot of programs, a lot of training programs out there in World Triathlon that are very intensity focused, and I get a lot of athletes that are used to doing a lot more intensity, and are also like burned out by intensity, meaning that they lack a real like endurance. They lack real endurance to approach the kind of races that that we race at, and I feel that there's a lot of coaches out there that because triathlon is not a sport that's as established and as like the traditional sports, I feel that there's a lot of coaches out there that are still working to find their own system, their own formula, and they end up having programs that have way too much intensity, and the athletes, when they come to the squad, end up having, there's this clash in philosophies where they're used to just doing a lot more intensity, less volume, and also the impact that those high intensity programs had on their bodies throughout the years makes a big, big difference in their performance now and adapting to our training now.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I think we'll come back to to that in regard to your training philosophy and so on in just a little bit. Just before that, though, as we kind of talked about already, the season can be very long, especially when a year like this, you have the grand final in Abu Dhabi in November, you have Super League, you have World Triathlon, you have athletes racing Grand Prix races and all sorts of racing. Some athletes, short course athletes, double in long course. How do you, obviously the athletes have their say and the federation has their say, how do you find the balance between racing options, when to race, when not to race, when to focus on training? How does that work?
Well, that's entirely driven by the race calendar. I think that the question of periodization is one of those things that in our sport, we are still tied down to the tradition of having, like the tradition that comes from running, for example, where you have very few events, you have two or three peaks over the season and all that stuff. And that's where periodization comes in. But the reality of all triathlon is that you end up racing a lot. You end up racing sometimes in blocks of like two, three races in a row, and so periodization comes out of necessity, not as something that's going to come out of a textbook. And in general terms, I would say that we have more classic periodization during the off season and building the during the off season, January, February, March, April, and but then when the season starts and races start, we end up having the content of training ends up being very very specific, and any concept of traditional periodization goes out the window. If you want me to be a little more technical, I would say that concepts like similar to block periodization are easier to apply to world triathlon racing than more traditional models for periodization. But I would say that ends up being like totally driven by race calendar, and ends up that in season the specific content is going to be very high.
Yeah, I think what one thing that's really interesting to me is how athletes, when they race really frequently, like right now we have Super League and the athletes are racing, what is it, 4 times in 5 weeks, I believe. So almost every week. How what does it look like between the races there? What does the training look like? Is it really, really toned down in terms of the volume that they're doing and just some fine tuning of intensity, or do they still kind of train because they need to maintain some base fitness for races later, Olympic distance races and so on? Or what can you talk a bit more about that?
The necessity term is going to come in. Just like in between races, the constraints, the level of constraints are really, really high for training, and adding to like racing every week, you also have like the travel aspect, which basically, even if athletes are in Europe and they race in Europe next week, they're still going to lose 1 day of training or 2 days of training to travel. So basically, if you have one race on a Sunday to Sunday, you're not going to have a lot of opportunities to train. I think that trying to cram training in between races is not going to be a good idea. You just have to accept the reality that after you race 3 weeks in a row, your levels of fitness are not going to be great. But that's balanced out by your race sharpness is very high, and your fitness levels were maintained by the specific stimulus. But it's a tough balance to create between maintaining some training loads and racing well off every week. And I'm not ashamed to say that I privilege freshness on race day over trying to, you know, let's get like a 3-hour ride here midweek to keep our fitness up. I want athletes to be fresh and as sharp as possible on race day. And that might mean different things for different athletes, but for sure, privilege sharpness and freshness over maintaining fitness. And then if we have like a week where we can get back to some volume, then that's what we do. And that's what the athletes that did that are doing all the races in Super League last week had like a little bit of a volume freshener. And now going into the fourth race of Super League, they are back to some sharpness sessions and then racing over the weekend.
I stand corrected. It's 5 races in 6 weeks mm-hmm. in Super League. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you have athletes like Taylor Spivey and Miriam Casillas are racing. Is there, and Summer Rappaport was in the latest race, but she's not racing the series. Mm-hmm. If you can just use athletes like Taylor and Miriam as examples, roughly how many hours would they have gotten in the week when they were racing on both weekends? And then in contrast, how much did they manage when, or how much did they do when they had that racing week or this weekend off as we're recording?
It's going to sound a little like, maybe I don't want to say it, but like to tell the truth, I don't know how many hours they were doing in these race weeks. I just focus on today, or like when planning a week of training, I'm just thinking about on Tuesday, what do these athletes need to do on this day? And then on Wednesday, what do they need to do this day? What is, like, I have like a concept for the week and then adjust sessions to that concept and the constraints that I have for the week. I can tell you that, for example, we have ways of doing things that the athletes are very accustomed to. And it's kind of like a little bit of like a plug and play training protocol that the athletes execute going into a race. And that this is done because we've done it many times before and we've had good performances out of it. And also like the familiarity of the program, of the training program helps the athletes perform as well. So the races, like for example, looking at the transition between the last race in Europe, Super League, what was it? Was it Munich? And then going to Malibu. We already have like a protocol of how is the training schedule when you have like a transcontinental flight and then racing in 3 days. So we kind of like, the athletes already know what kind of training they're going to be doing. We plug and play that concept and the athletes go and execute. So ends up being that like the concept's already established. The volume intensity is going to change a little bit, but the processes are very familiar to the athletes, and it's not really like we're not really like inventing something for this occasion, but more like established processes that we have, and then the athletes can just focus on executing on race day.
And you mentioned that you're not afraid of making sure the athlete is fresh on race day, so not doing unnecessary long rides, for example. What's your view on the intensity that is needed in race week, or that is beneficial in race week, versus what is too much? Like, where do you stand on that spectrum?
Well, I believe that you can have like a matrix, like I told you, like a training matrix, a concept for the week, and then the athletes have inputs on volume and intensity by feel. So basically, is they have ranges of volume and intensity, and they can adjust depending on the day and how they feel, and also like how they operate as athletes. They can adjust those ranges to their needs. So my experience is that even if I send the same training plan for 4 or 5 different athletes, the way they adjust training and the way they adjust the ranges is going to bring the individual characteristics of the training plan for that week. And then what I see in, you know, post analysis, that indeed athletes adjust ranges and adjust volume depending on their personal preferences, and that's where individualization comes in. I'm not big on just like being very precise in like finding the right formula. Instead, what I ask the athletes is, let's work on finding what's going to be working for you this week inside the concept that we have for the week.
Makes total sense to have athlete autonomy there, because how is it possible that a coach could know exactly the number of intervals or the number of minutes of intensity that is needed? But yeah, it makes more sense that the athlete knows kind of what the reason is for the workout they're doing, and then within that and within some parameters, they can adjust it based on how they're feeling on the day. And I think I've seen an Instagram post where you hold up a sign with something like "Write your own workouts." Is that what you were referring to with that post?
No, I was being sarcastic. I think that one thing that I think is funny, and you've noticed, like my relationship with social media fluctuates through the years, and now it's definitely at its lowest point, which I would qualify it as the highest point for me. But I was just being sarcastic, because I think one thing that's funny is that every time I post a workout, that's what generates more talk and more questions, and it's not really about like the workout that we're doing, you know. That's going to be super important. While protocol is important, you know, specific workouts are not going to be important. So it was probably like me making fun of the audience, which is a little bit in line with my sarcastic personality. I would say that like athlete autonomy is going to be important, but more important than that is athlete ownership. The athlete making the training program their training program, and that can be done through belief. Basically, the athlete like, hey, my coach gave me this program, and I believe that this is the best program, so it's my program. But also, being at a race site, and like it happened in Malibu, where there's 5 different athletes that have very similar programs, and and maybe medium thinks, well, Taylor is doing 5 reps, but I'm doing 6 because I feel that's what's best for me, you know? So making the program your own, either through belief or through personal adjustments, makes the formula, the system work so much better in terms of, hey, this is my program, this is what's best for me today. And I try to have as many opportunities as possible for athletes to have input on that. And that's usually like in terms of ranges where we can go to, let's say, the track, and I tell the athletes, well, we're going to be working on, you know, 14 to 18, 400, something like that. And the athletes can choose their own session, and with it, they can increase ownership over the session, get more out of them, and also they know better than me what they are able to do that day. So all this is connected to increasing individuality in the training prescription by increasing like ownership that the athletes have over their program.
That makes sense. I assume that you talk with your athletes about it and educate them in making the choice individually for them, but do you ever have any issues with athletes perhaps making a choice based on what others are doing, maybe with newer athletes or younger athletes?
Yes, but I always feel that like it's going to be part of their learning process, you know, and I empower them to be their own person and just make their own choices. And sometimes I think I have the athletes do a very good job at just like focusing on themselves and not the others. You can imagine that in a large squad with a lot of athletes, it's very important that everyone is focused on themselves and what they're doing instead of like looking around and seeing what the others are doing and competing with the others and all that. So empowering them to focus on their work and then use the group as like a lifting environment for them in a positive way, I think that's super, super important to be able to manage the group in a positive way.
I guess we've already transitioned into training kind of organically, but if you can describe your, if you want to call it training philosophy, for lack of a better term, in a few key points, what would those key points be?
Well, my training philosophy is like, I feel like I'm like filling up a Training Peaks coach questionnaire, huh? Traditionally, and this is like a pet peeve of mine throughout many years, is just like, I always feel that like training philosophy is like a concept that kind of like, it's a little bit of like a selling concept of just like, hey, I'm a volume guy, I'm an intensity guy, I'm a whatever you want to call it, I'm a polarized training guy, I'm now like a threshold model guy. I feel that like when you think about training, if you think about training philosophy, I think that like you are putting yourself in a corner, in a little.
It's more about the approach to training. If that, I don't mean to label yourself. I definitely don't think that's a good thing, and that's not the intention of the question. Uh-huh. It's more, the approach, and we have discussed some aspects of it already. But yeah, that's how I would describe it, maybe in a better term.
Yeah, I understand. I understand where you're coming from, and me lashing out is not at you. but basically, like, what I was going to say is I don't want to be, like, in a box where basically, like, this is what we do. This is the box we are in. And definitely have a way broader mind of like, what do we do in terms of training? And that might change year to year or even like inside a season, we might change things. And also like athlete input has a lot to do with it. There's some athletes enjoy training a certain way, and I think that it's my job as a coach also to provide them with just like stimulus that are going to be something that they will embrace completely. So in terms of like training philosophy, I wouldn't say like, well, I'm a volume guy that does a little bit of intensity. My approach is like polarized. I wouldn't say something like that. It's more that we have a way of doing things that it's more a question of like execution and how we operate on the day to day and less about the training content and what we do. And also adjust things based on athlete feedback. In general terms, I would say that like some philosophies in endurance training that I am more, that I'm closer to, would be, for example, polarized training or whatever you want to call it. Even though like lately it seems that everything is polarized training, but I would say that like I am closer to a polarized approach than other approaches. But for example, like in the last two seasons, we've been doing a lot of fat max training on the bike or Ingebrigtsen training on the run, and those concepts are definitely not polarized training. And so I feel that like in terms of training philosophy, I would say that like flexibility on the approach and also have training that I feel that either by the specific content that it's got or by the personal preference that athletes have for it, I will then like choose that. So instead of like being in a box where like, this is what we do, this is our approach, I think that more individuals and specificity are going to be the key factors in the overall training philosophy.
And when you say that the execution on the day-to-day is more important than the training content itself, one aspect of that that we already talked a lot about is the ability for the athlete to make decisions within certain parameters mm-hmm. around what is the right amount of things to do. Are there any other things that you would say fall within that good execution versus bad execution? What other things should athletes consider? Like would you educate a new athlete to the squad that this is how you execute mm-hmm. well mm-hmm. on the day-to-day?
Well, we work with a few different training templates for the week where the athletes already know what to expect from, you know, for example, Tuesday, today, we had a hard swim, hard bike, cruise run. The athletes already know what to expect, and they already know that if they had a hard bike today, they're not going to have a hard run tomorrow. So in terms of like day-to-day execution is how can we have good sessions from day to day so that we can back up sessions? For example, when athletes come in, I've had several athletes that basically only they do things a lot by feel, where basically it's like, today I feel amazing, I'm just going to destroy this session, and I really don't care how I feel tomorrow. And then tomorrow they don't feel great and they have like a bad session. So when I talk about execution is, how can we have a very solid week of training where we have very good training days, one day to the other, to the other, to the other, and then we back up training days, and then we back up training weeks, and with this consistency in execution, then we're going to have a very consistent process. So that's where training execution comes in terms of, like, obviously the sessions that we're doing are important and what we're doing is important, but also achieving a level of execution that allows you to back up training days and then back up training weeks is very, very important.
Mm. And other than these general training topics that we have discussed, if we go into the three disciplines of swimming, biking, and running, I'll leave this as an open-ended question for you, but are there any things you would say can kind of be highlighted as things that are, let's say, fundamental within how the swim training is structured, or bike, or something that's more important in swim training, or something that's more important in bike training and run training, and so on?
Mm-hmm. Well, in my mind, I always think that we're doing a lot of different things on the swim, but my athletes are probably going to disagree with that. In terms of swimming, I feel that through the years, we've had a very solid swimming program that has allowed for the athletes with a strong swimming background to perform at a high level, but also has allowed for development for the majority of athletes. And the swim program is based on consistency. We have a swim program that we consistently swim for the developing athletes. We consistently swim 28 to 30K a week year round. And in training weeks, not race weeks. And there's some aspects of the swimming that are constants in our program that I feel are very, very have worked out well for us in the past. I would say that the swim program is very, very polarized. We have two sessions a week where we do some intensity, and this is going to be either threshold or probably like above LT2 or VO2 max main sets, and then the bulk of the training, the swim training is no fluff cruise intensity, which would be something like, let's say it like generally below LT1, but like I said, no fluff. So basically we might do sets of low intensity swimming that are going to be freestyle nonstop for 40, 50 minutes, something like that. So basically we're just not like, I feel that like a lot of programs have a lot of fluff in terms of like, well, we're swimming 200 with 50 kick or something that just like does not maintain a high level of volume at low intensity. So I would think that would be like the main feature of the swim program. Having said that, for this season, I revamped the structure for our sessions, and we started doing some kicking, some drill work, some sprint work, and in the form of a preset at almost every session, and the sessions for this season looked a little more like traditional swimming sessions, and this was like a pretty big change from previous years, but I think with good results. In terms of cycling, there's the program is also a lot very very polarized in terms of, again, two intensity sessions a week and supported by volume at low intensity, and I wouldn't say that like the bike program is like super, like, you know, revolutionary. It's just about being consistent in a polarized concept. In terms of running, I've played with different concepts throughout the years. the latest kick that I'm on right now is on threshold running and more of Ingebrigtsen model of running that I think works well for some athletes. Other athletes are still doing like a lot of the stuff that we've been doing through the years. Perhaps the latest, the difference has been better intensity control in the last couple of seasons that we've been working with, and trying to teach the athletes to run slower for their solid slash threshold stuff, and try to slow them down in terms of the training intensity that they follow. So this would be like a summary of like our approach to swim bike run.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect summary. Do you on the bike would one of the key sessions be something like a crit workout or something like working in groups to simulate the demands of the events, or would the races themselves, seeing as your athletes race a lot, that the races provide enough training for that?
Yeah, the stuff that we do in terms of like crit riding and mostly with the women is going to be more technical work in terms of technical riding in a crit-like environment. And that's not always possible because it's very hard to find locations worldwide to do that kind of work. I think that once you start doing race pace, race intensity in a crit environment, I think that the safety level of that is not very high. I have like serious safety concerns with doing crit-like efforts at race intensity, and so that's where racing or doing sessions where we do pace line riding or group riding at a high intensity, but a low technical, or the course is not technical, and the technical aspect of the riding comes from riding with a group. That's where the focus is with specific contents on the bike. For the man, I've been lucky to have like a lot of riders that are very good on the bike, and they don't need like particular skill in developing their skills on their technical skills on the bike. So we don't do a lot of or not at all technical riding in a crit course. But again, like it's like a kind of like a necessity thing. Is tomorrow I have an athlete that needs that kind of work, then obviously we will do that kind of work.
Mm. And would the cycling workouts, would you have a mixture of kind of very high kind of spiky sessions, considering that going around corners, dead turns, and so on, that's required in the races, or would you also have some longer intervals, considering that the bike is the longest of the three disciplines, so there is also an endurance component to the intensity that's required there.
Mm-hmm. Well, for sure, we have a few sessions that you haven't seen in like triathlon training books, huh? I feel that traditionally, in world triathlon, I'm sure that the coaches have access to the same power files that I do, and what you see in power files is that like high variability of riding, very intense riding, and obviously like having a high threshold is helpful, and being a good rider in terms of fitness, overall fitness is obviously helpful, but having sessions that are have demands that are very close to racing is very, very important. And for sure, we have a few sessions, not just obviously, like when you're doing a baseline session, there's going to be some natural accelerations and spikes in power that are going to be race-like. But at the same time, like you mentioned, the accelerations out of each turn are going to have to be simulated in training in some way. So we have a few sessions that are going to be based on the like variability and repeating a high kind of effort and with recoveries. So these variable sessions are I would say like more introduced close to races, and then we use them in the middle of the season as well.
Yeah. And just one final follow-up question is regarding running. So, and this is another thing that I picked up from your Instagram. So whether it's sarcasm or not, you'll have to to reveal now. But it seemed like you were doing a bit of quite a bit of hill running. So hill reps on the run. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
For sure, we use some hill running at the beginning of the season and throughout the season. I can tell you that hill running and maintenance of hill running is one of the things that are athlete driven. Athletes, if hills are missing throughout the season, athletes ask for them and want to do at least like maintenance work with hill running. Hill running have like a bigger factor in our program when we worked in California, which is a very hilly place in terms of like short steep hills, and we did a lot of that. In Monte Gordo, it's a very flat place, or it's you have to drive to get some good hills, so maybe less of a factor. As you know, throughout history, a lot of programs were very focused on hills, also because they were in hilly places. But the advantage of hill running is that you can do very high intense work in a very safe way in terms of impact. Between doing a hill session or a track session at very high intensity, I would prefer to do a hill session because it's a lot safer in overall in terms of like impact for the runners. But it's also going to be like dependent on like where we are and what we can do and where we can work to do those hills.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and you have to make use of your environment, I guess, depending on where you are. And when one advantage that you definitely will have in Monte Gordo compared to California is that the risk of getting hit by a car must be like 1%, because as soon as you head into the hills there, the traffic is very, very light. So a nice and safe place for cycling, at least from my experience.
Yes, for sure. Like while you've been there, Monte Gordo is incredibly safe. Once you hit the hills, you're just there's nobody out there. We've done some hill repeats on the bike in some roads that sometimes we do the whole set that lasts almost an hour and there's not one car going on that road, and you hit on a very important point, which is for me when picking a place to train is overall safety. For the athletes, for sure. Like for me as a coach, my nightmare, my worst case scenario is when an athlete has an accident, and for sure, I would hate myself if I told an athlete to ride at this in this road that's very busy, and then ends up having an accident. That's also, we used to work in California and it was incredibly busy and we had some accidents that happened there, and things in the US overall are not getting better for cyclists are getting worse, and basically, like, the only place I see having a training camp is going to be in Flagstaff, because it ends up being that there's only two options to ride there, but they're very safe, and that's huge for us when picking a place to train.
Just a few more general questions coming back to your coaching. So first, what is something that you've changed your mind about in training or in coaching in the last few years, and or that you do differently now than you used to do a few years ago?
Well, I change my mind often. I feel that changing your mind is hopefully a sign of maturity, and I feel that as the years gone by, I've been able to change my mind more often, and when confronted with evidence or something is not working or something needs to change. So I don't see any value in having the right answer because I've had it for a long time. I see value in doing the right thing, having the right answer, and having a good performance / outcome from finding that answer. And it doesn't matter if I had it all along or if I had it just now, or if others have the answer. And a lot of the times athletes might come to me with the right answer, and that makes me change my mind. I feel that stubbornness is not a good characteristic in coaching. I think that being able to be adaptable and changing your ways in face of evidence is a positive characteristic. So, you know, when you ask me what have you changed your mind, I'm like, so many times. I don't know if I can find you an example. I think that.
That's fine. I think that's a good answer. You don't have to dig for a specific example.
Okay.
That's completely fine. Is there anything that you're particularly focused on right now as part of your learning or coaching development, or particularly interested in?
I think that the biggest thing at this stage of my coaching, I think that there's two things that I'm focused on. The first one is, after saying that I change my mind often, but also how can I continue to converge the way the squad operates into getting better and better. Obviously, like, through the years, there's been some characteristics in the way we work that have surfaced as convergent to an ideal way of working. And I, as part of my coaching development, I want to keep finding those things. And a lot of these things are hidden, and I can still find them. Like, hey, what are the main aspects of what we do that have been working throughout the years that we can build up even more? We can highlight even more. And so this is like a concurrent process with changing my mind in the things that haven't been working that need to be discarded. The second thing that I'm focused on coaching development is being flexible and creating environments that work for the athletes that might contain me being there or not being there, might mean my intervention or my non-intervention, but basically is this working? Can we make it better in terms of the environment around the athletes? And this might be something that might have different shapes, might mean me showing up. For example, we had the camp in Font-Romeu in France, And I show up there and everybody was there. And we had like a huge group and we worked together and it was an amazing camp. But at the same time, can we create an environment where three athletes are together and they're working very well and maybe I come in and work with them for a week? So finding flexible coaching environments that work is part of what I do. Another thing that I'm also always like focused on and is on in finding ways to increase ownership and commitment that the athletes have in embracing what we do. And I feel that this is an area that has required from me growth in terms of letting go of control and being more open to different ways of working with the athletes so that they are open to being in complete control or not in complete control, but in control of what they do and creating like a relationship with me where we're more and more on the same page. So these are a little like abstract concepts, but these are the things that I'm thinking about, like how can I become a better coach is, you know, these two things.
Yeah, no, that's great. And if you could give three pieces of advice to the listeners of this podcast that would help them improve their endurance performance, what would that be?
You know, I'm not very good at giving advice because in line with what I just said, commitment and ownership, I always feel that like the word advice is a little bit of fire and forget, which is basically what you're asking me of doing would be like, well, why don't you put this up out there and maybe people will do it. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll do it for a while. But I would say that in terms of, you know, endurance training process, I think the biggest piece of advice I would give is find a process that is sustainable, that you are able to roll, that you are able to repeat, that you're able to do it today, tomorrow, next week, that you can keep rolling, keep doing this. And in order for you to find a sustainable process, a lot of things go into it. A lot of things about your environment, yourself, need to go into it to create a sustainable environment. I don't think any athletes, whatever the level, I don't think it's a good way of doing things where basically, I just need to get to that finish line, you know? You need to enjoy, you need to be in the process, you need to live for today, and then that finish line will come in eventually. So sustainability, I think, would be a big piece of advice that I would give. The other thing is the importance of health, and this is again like so important, and particularly like in the environment that I work in, like the level of injuries is incredibly high in triathlon. Athletes are always injured, and I would love to say that like, well, athletes in the squad are not injured. While I'm proud of the, let's call it, injury rates that we have, I still feel that we always can do a little better, and athletes and coaches can do a little better in focusing on health and injury prevention. And two things come into this. One is overall training load. One thing is the training load that you think you can do. The other is the training load that you're actually are able to do. And And in triathlon, in particularly like in running, which is the biggest source of injury in triathlon, there's a big tendency of like ignoring warning signs. Injuries that athletes have in running are very, very seldom little niggles that athletes did not pay attention through denial or not thinking that that is important or whatever it is. So we focus a lot on just like paying attention to warning signs, to issues that might pop up, which doesn't mean that we can prevent injuries. But I would say that like focusing on your health is incredibly important for any endurance athletes, elite athletes. Like I said, like I think it's like in elite triathlon, I think it's the rates of injury are simply too high, and I think we all can do a better job at it. I would say that like the third piece of advice that I would give is triathlon for sure for the people that are listening to here. Triathlon is a big part of their life. It's probably their biggest part of their life. And I would say embrace it. Embrace it. If triathlon is a big part of your life, then this is who you are. And there's nothing wrong with it. You know, so embracing who you are, I think, is important.
Yeah, no, that's all really great. I completely agree with all of that. And let's do the rapid-fire questions to finish off. So take just one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
Ooh, I haven't read a training book in a long time. So I can't even remember what was the last book that I read. It was probably one of those books that have like chapters of different scientists writing about there, but it was a little bit disappointing. And in terms of like,
resource can be a flexible term.
Yes. And in terms of like, you know, I don't listen to a lot of podcasts. And for example, like for your podcast, I do read the show notes quite often to your for some of your guests, because the show notes is just like they're great. Like I'm done with them in 5 minutes, and it's not a big time sink for sure. The biggest resource for me is going to be either scientific papers that sometimes, like I'm interested in some aspects of training, endurance training or training science, and I go and do some research on PubMed and look into it. And so I would say that like that's my biggest resource. And the other thing would be like to find books that are in areas that are, you know, loosely connected with coaching or with let's say like, I wouldn't say like self-help, but like personal growth kind of books that sometimes have concepts that are interesting to me. And so those are like the main things that I use as resource in what I do.
Well, I'm flattered that you read the show notes, and Bernard, who is writing the show notes, will be happy to hear that as well. that is very nice. And what's an important habit that you've benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
I think the biggest habit that I benefited for me was to create I would call it like a soft discipline for myself and those around me. I am not like I would say like discipline, when we hear about this word, we kind of like think about like you're in the army now, where basically like being disciplined means that you're a little bit of a robot that's always on time. And I don't see discipline like that. I would say like creating a soft discipline for myself would mean, you know, being on time, but doesn't have to be to the minute. Being able to deliver what people expect from me. Being honest and truthful in my interactions. And with that soft discipline, also create that soft discipline around myself. Just as an example, we have times to do training sessions that we have to do as a squad, but things don't have to be like by the minute. You know, if somebody's a little bit late, is not going to be a huge issue. Or, for example, we have, when we do camps, not every session is going to be coached. Athletes have sessions on their own every day, and with that, I create like athletes are doing the training, but I'm not there to just watch them or be with them. And with that, creating again this soft discipline, I think that this habit has benefited me a lot, because it took me a long time to realize that I could be a disciplined person. I could be a disciplined person without being overly strict or robot-like, and that benefited me and personally and also professionally a lot.
And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I think there's a saying that this says never meet your heroes, right? Because I'm not really like into hero worshiping. I think people's strengths are their ideas, and for sure there's been, you know, too many people to name that the strength of their ideas obviously created an impact with me and the way I think. And I think that's really, really important. But I wouldn't say like, oh, there's this person, or even like this person that I've never met or that I don't know, or a celebrity or somebody famous that has like a one-stop shop for inspiration and guidance. For sure, there's an aspect of like people's ideas are the strengths, not people themselves. And at the same time, there's also a lot of learning that can be done through via negativa, meaning you can learn a lot by seeing people doing it the wrong way, and you can do the right way. So the sources of learning, are all imperfect. And with that, tying yourself down to one personality or a few personalities that you say, like, these are the people that are really inspiring me, I think is limiting. I would say for sure that the biggest source of inspiration that I have on my day-to-day job is performance and the athletes. It's incredibly inspirational to me when my athletes do well. I sometimes say that, coaching, never a good day, because when you have a large squad, if they're doing a race or a weekend, not everybody's going to do great. Somebody's going to have a bad race. But when athletes do well, when there's good performances, when a lot of athletes had a good day, that's where I draw my source of inspiration. Is performance is seeing like the work that we do every day to just come into fruition. Whenever one of my athletes does really well, people sometimes use the expression with me, it's just like, are you surprised by it? And I say, no, this is why we work every day. This is why I come to work every day, so that we can win this race, that we can do really well, that people cross the finish line and they had a really good day. That's why we do this.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic note to end on. So just before that, you mentioned your relationship with social media, but for the people that want to give it a go and follow you, where can they find you?
I'm on, there's rumors that my Twitter account is still exists. I don't know for sure, but I'm on PS Triathlon on both Twitter and Instagram. I'm definitely a little more active on Instagram. I think there's something called like Tip Top or something like that. I don't have an account there, so it would be mostly like Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you so much, Paolo. It was great to have you on and great to chat to you, and I'm sure that the listeners will enjoy it.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with some links that we mentioned, including a video on Erik Lagerström's and Paula Finlay's YouTube channel that shows some of the work they did when Paolo was visiting in person. Also, if you have the opportunity, make sure to check out the old podcasts that Paolo used to do with Joel Filial. I have linked to them as well. Next Monday, I interview Andrew Sellers on the topics of testing, physiology, systems-based endurance training, and respiratory training. Andrew is a really smart guy, knows a lot about physiology, and he's a real innovator as well. So that would be a really cool one. Make sure you tune in for that. And then just a quick reminder that we are basically at the end of the season. 73 Worlds is still to happen, but for many, the season is already over. And now is a great time to start working with a coach. If you know that you really want to improve your performance or you have some specific goals that you're working towards, it doesn't matter if you're newer to the sport or if you're a seasoned veteran or even a pro athlete. We work with athletes of all different levels, so feel free to contact us and reach out and discuss how and if we can help you in the best way. Check out more information on scientifictriathlon.com, where we have plenty of details, or just email us directly. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free fuel and hydration planner to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs, and get a specific and effective race strategy, and book a free video consultation with the team if you want to refine it further. Use the code TTS22 at checkout for 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products. And thank you to Zenate. Use the Zenate swim trainer to improve your technique, power, stamina, and swim training consistency. You can try the Zenate risk-free for up to 30 days and get special Zenate and TTS bundle, including the swim trainer and a number of Zenate training plans and on-demand workouts on zenateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.